Welcome to the Being Human podcast, brought to you by Relate Malaysia. Join us in our conversations about what makes us human and why we think and behave in the ways that we do. We'll talk about mental health, emotional well-being, and how we can sometimes feel on top of the world, and other times like life calls for a large tub of ice cream and a big spoon. So come on in, relax, and let's explore this puzzle of being human together.
Hello and welcome to the Being Human podcast. My name is Dr. Chua Suk Ning, and today I'm joined by Dr. Laura Dietz, who is a clinical and developmental psychologist and an associate professor of clinical rehabilitation and mental health counseling at the University of Pittsburgh. With over a decade of experience, Laura has dedicated her research to understanding the family risk factors for depression and developing psychosocial interventions for mood disorders in young people. As a graduate of the University of Pittsburgh and having completed postdoctoral work at leading institutions, Laura is a leading expert in family-based interpersonal psychotherapy for depressed pre-adolescents aged 8 to 12 years. Currently serving as an associate professor of clinical mental health counseling at the University of Pittsburgh, Dr. Dietz trains clinicians in interpersonal psychotherapy for depressed adolescents as well as family-based IPT. Welcome to the show. Laura, how are you?
I'm doing well. I'm just delighted to be with you. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Thank you for waking up in the morning and thank me for staying up late at night.
That is correct. I have a cup of coffee and I can't think of a better way to start my morning.
Let's jump right into it. While reading your profile, I realized, oh man, you and I might have some, I don't know whether we know some people in common, but I did my undergraduate research work with John and Bella, who studied depression in adolescence.
Very cool.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. And you know, his work was international and was in China as well, looking at universal risk factors of depression. So, we are living in a world where I think there's a lot of news articles that young people nowadays, there's always the young people nowadays in this sort of vague, generalized, way of referencing them. So is that what attracted you to studying mood disorders in young people? So what kind of led you to go that route?
That's such a good question. And I don't want to make this longer than it has to be, but I had somewhat of a circuitous interest in studying young people. So when I graduated from college, I was not ready to go on to graduate school right away. And I wanted to learn a little bit more about research. And so I was hired as a research assistant, and back in the day, collecting questionnaires on paper, not on iPads.
Back in the day, it's called paper pen measures. Because literally.
Yes, paper and pencil measures, literally. And I was employed as, this was when I was in my early 20s. I worked at Brown University and some of its affiliated hospitals in Providence, Rhode Island. And I worked on studies that were looking at intergenerational risk factors for young children. So I worked on a study that actually looked at intergenerational transmission of attachment styles. So I interviewed young mothers, mostly Latinx and young women of color who had recently delivered infants. And while they were pregnant, I would do interviews with them about their own attachment styles. And then when their children turned 18 months, we actually brought them in the lab and we did Ainsworth strain situation to look at the children's attachment styles. And, it was really interesting because I do think that, I was always really interested in kind of these family issues and how psychopathology, distress and depression, trauma run in families. And how my thought was, how can the next generation do better? And when that study wrapped up, then I worked on a study. Now, this was back in the 1990s, when there was a lot of panic and catastrophe about babies being born addicted to crack cocaine. And so I worked on a multi-site study still at Brown University, looking at, what are the developmental outcomes of infants who are born exposed to cocaine and other drugs. What I loved about that study is that it was incredibly rigorous. It said, we're not going to compare, what we really are interested in is the effects of these specific drugs. And our control group was matched on everything. So if moms were depressed, if moms were smoking, if moms were low income, all of those things we matched for, except the cocaine exposure. And one of the things that we saw is that, in lots of ways, there were risks even in our control group. So I really, as a young person who was interested in becoming a psychologist, I had a lot of interest in the social determinants of mental health, interpersonal factors, and generational relationships. And how they affect children's outcomes. Then when I went to graduate school, I was working on a study that really kind of did a deep dive into maternal depression. So looking at women who had postpartum or peripartum depressions, and then following their children developmentally. So I really came at this work having a lot of experience thinking about kind of the front end. What are the risk factors that affect young children? Then when I was getting deeper and deeper into my training, I was often working with school age and pre-adolescent children who were experiencing their first depressive episodes. And I was really interested to see when I was meeting an 11-year-old kid who was suicidal, who had made a suicide attempt, who was experiencing a first acute hospitalization for depression. I was really interested when I was talking with them and interviewing their families that a lot of those issues that I had been immersed in even prior to my graduate work were all specters. They were all kind of lingering in the history, right? So a history of trauma, a history of depression in the parents, definitely struggles with significant social issues and really feeling like, wow, we can do better for treating these young people. But, certainly working with younger children, how do we include the family? I found that in my own clinical work, I felt like I had the most traction in involving families in young children, in children's treatment. So, after I got my degree and I was doing my own independent research, I really thought about how do I manualize this? How do I try to capture important aspects of treatment that addresses, children's mental health by helping and supporting families to support their children's mental health? And so right now in my clinical work, I am really focused primarily on treating children and adolescents. And yes, definitely, I think that in the last 5 years, we've been hearing more and more about the epidemic of adolescent and children's mental health. Certainly during COVID, we saw increases in depression, suicidality, anxiety. And, in the last 3 years, there have been epidemic levels of parents bringing children into emergency rooms, kids expressing more suicidality, self-identifying as having a range of mental health disorders. And so I think that in some ways, the events of the pandemic have really kind of brought to light this idea that young people are struggling and the stakes feel high, particularly in terms of rates of suicidality, you know, kids that are beginning, that are, you know, saying, I'm having thoughts of hurting myself, and families, schools, communities, churches trying to figure out how to best support young people. It has really been a struggle, and access to care and availability is certainly, you know, that's always been an issue, but we're seeing that even more with, mm-hmm. you know, a recent demand, you know, for these sorts of services.
I love seeing adolescent clients. I trained in a youth clinic in Montreal. So this is actually my favorite population, but it's really hard to see many adolescents here because the families, you know, I think there's still a lot of stigma around mental illness and this sort of struggle. So it's often, you know, an identified patient, you know, like, you've got an issue, you go and see it, it's not about us. And understandably, there is a defensiveness that says, I didn't make you sick, and I don't want to think about what the, you know, the role I played, because they immediately feel blamed, especially, you know, in today's world where there is a lot of blaming on, like, the cancel culture and the condemnation. For the people I think listening, is family-based, like, is that the only way, or is that the most effective way to help an adolescent or pre-adolescent with depression?
Yeah, so I think that it really depends. You know, it doesn't have to be an either or. So one of the things that I saw is that particularly treating kids who are 12 and under, this is, you know, early in my training, you know, the parents were often, what do I want to say? They were often a captive audience. You know, this was back in the day where they would have to arrange transportation to get their child who was under 12 to, you know, a psychologist's office or a mental health clinic. And they would often sit in the waiting room. And one of the things that, you know, I kind of, you know, we all kind of know, we used to joke about, like, you know, after a session, what is that? What is the transportation, the walk, the ride, the train ride, the subway ride home like, you know, with parent and child? And oftentimes, you know, we saw parents as the gatekeepers. If the parents thought that the child was getting something out of the therapy, they would continue to bring them in because, you know, as you know, parents have so many competing demands. It's not easy to get your child, or back in the day, prior to the explosion in telehealth, it wasn't easy to get your child to a weekly doctor's appointment, right? So there had to be a real investment. And so one of the things that we knew is that parents were often, for the younger kids, a gatekeepers to even going to therapy. So the idea is, if a parent thought that a therapy was helping and important, they would get the child there. You know, they would, you know, cancel the appointment and reschedule. So, you know, the idea was, how do we get the parents involved in a way that is comfortable for the clinician, right? We don't want to be doing therapy with a parent. We don't want to bring a parent in. Everything you're saying about parents' defensiveness, how do we partner with the parent and try to actively cut through that defensiveness, right? That basically, we are not saying that you caused your child's depression. We are not saying that at all. We're saying that we need to partner with you. You know, we meet with your child once a week, or once every 2 weeks. You're there all the time. We also felt like if we could kind of present, let parents know what we're working on with their child, right? There would be less of that kind of, you know, kind of grilling the child after the session. What did you say? What did you talk about? And so the idea was, what was, you know, not that family-based for the younger kids was always best, but the idea is that, you know, we couldn't ignore the family. That the family was more so than when you're working with adolescents. You know, in some ways, older adolescents they're becoming more able at negotiating their own care. We have many adolescents who would get themselves to the appointments and so that was certainly something that, you know, it really depends. I think it also depends on what the issues are that are complicating their mood disorder. So certainly, you know, one of the things we can do is, and what we see a lot is, sometimes, you know, youth and clients will come in and they want to just talk about what's bothering them. They want to vent. And, you know, honestly, you know, in some ways, if there are conversations that are difficult to have with parents, problems that can be, you know, negotiated or solved, the opportunity to invite parents in for a session with an older adolescent is not a bad idea. And oftentimes you have adolescents saying, no, I'd rather not. I think the parents are also a little concerned. What is this going to be like? I'm not quite sure what how the therapist is going to handle this, you know. No, so I think that, you know, Sook, I really do believe that we need to have more transparency about the therapeutic process. I think that's something that can help people feel more comfortable engaging in it. And I understand what you're saying. A lot of stigma. What's going to happen? You know, am I going to go in and be analyzed? Am I going to be judged? Am I going to get feedback that this is my fault? What's happening with my child is my fault. And, you know, I'm doing the best that I can. You know, it is interesting. I have found that when I've worked with younger children using family-based IPT, you know, one of the things that we talk to the parents about is their own self-care. Hey, how are you handling this? This is a lot. This is a lot to have a child that you're super concerned about. You know, your 11-year-old, your 10-year-old is depressed. Your young child is having thoughts of taking their own life. How are you handling this? And, you know, oftentimes, you know, what are you doing to take care of yourself? You know, here I am asking you to really be a support for your child, but this is a lot. And, you know, one of the things that I've seen is that it being able to engage parents in their children's work, when they see that their kids are getting better, sometimes, you know, it relieves the stigma for them to seek their own care. So, right, you know, it's really hard to tell a parent who's, you know, 11-year-old is in the hospital for a suicide attempt, oh, you know, it's time for you to get your own support. You need to take care of yourself. You know, parents are very likely to say, I'm going to be okay when my child is okay. And then when their child is making some progress, sometimes it's, you know, they're thinking, wow, that maybe that was helpful. Maybe I can do that for myself.
That's such an excellent point. And I really love the way you said we're partnering with parents. And they're looking up for parents as well. It's not just, you know, let's, you know, focus on one individual, but understanding that, you know, that person lives in a social unit. IPT is still quite new in Malaysia. So, you know, could you maybe just break it down? What do people actually do in sessions? Because, you know, maybe some of our listeners would be like, wow, that sounds so nice. You know, Dr. Dietz is like, sounds like such a nice person. I would like to do this, but I don't know what I actually do other than she was asking me about my self-care. You know, so what can someone expect going to IPT or family-based IPT, and how does it actually help someone get better?
So IPT was originally developed for adults with depressive disorders, right? And so basically it was, you know, back in the day in the early 1970s, it was pretty remarkable because, you know, at the time, you know, long-term psychoanalytic or psychodynamic therapy was really the model. And IPT really was a way to kind of talk about therapeutic principles that I think were very accessible to people that might not have been, you know, schooled in kind of a traditional European model of psychoanalysis. So what IPT is, it's a time-limited treatment. So right off the bat, IPT is saying you're not going to be in therapy 5 days a week for 3 years, right? We're going to meet, there's a beginning point, there's an ending point, and there are certain tasks that we're going to do, right? So, you know, it's very transparent. So IPT has, it's an intervention, usually anywhere between 12 to 16 sessions with some flexibility, but it's broken into three phases. And we talk to clients about this, right? So the first phase is really an extended intake, getting to know you, really kind of doing a deep dive into understanding the nature of the distress that the individual is experiencing, right? Talking about, you know, getting a timeline. So how long has this been going on? Have there been other times in your life that you felt like this? And then trying to understand kind of the symptoms that they're having. So, you know, identifying symptoms, how long have they lasted? What are some significant events that have gone on in your life? Then one of the things that we do in interpersonal psychotherapy, the idea is that our interpersonal relationships, interpersonal events, like grieving the loss of a loved one, life changes, significant arguments or disputes with significant people in our lives, and general feelings of loneliness or disconnection from people can have an effect on our mood. And so the idea is interpersonal psychotherapy says we need to kind of look at what's happening in your relationships, what's happening in your life, and within your relationships with other people that could have an effect on your mood. So the first phase of treatment really looks at symptoms, how long have they lasted, and then we do a deep dive into what sort of things have been going on in your life. Then we do a mapping of close relationships. We want to get to know with our clients, you know, who are the major players in your life? Who are the people that you get support from? Who are the people that you're arguing with? Who are the people that you go to for support? And oftentimes, look, what we'll realize is that many people who are experiencing mood symptoms or emotional distress are struggling in their relationships, right? They're experiencing loneliness. They've experienced a significant loss, that they've made a life change, which has left them without established support networks. And so, you know, at the end of our first 4 to 5 sessions, what we do as IPT therapists is we ask a lot of questions about what's going on. We get a really detailed picture. And then collaboratively, we say to clients, okay, what do we attribute some of these symptoms of distress to? And how can we make things better? And so IPT in some ways basically says, okay, there are basically 4 focal areas that we can work on. We can work on mood and depression as related to bereavement or grief. For many people, that is going to stand out pretty quickly. And so, you know, if that was the case, we would say, okay, you know, your mood is really linked to these feelings of extreme loss. And that makes a lot of sense. That is true for so many people. How are we going to help you not get over the loss, but how are we going to get you to be able to grieve and carry that loss as you move forward in your life? And that is not an easy thing. The second problem area might be someone is experiencing significant life changes. They've gotten a divorce. They've moved to a new city. They've been fired. They've been hired. They are a new parent, right? And adjusting to an entirely new routine. So in those situations, we're really saying to clients, okay, you know, the focus of our work is going to be talking about how are we going to help you kind of get your arms around this huge new change that's happened in your life? And we have some ideas. How are we going to help you connect with your existing resources, develop new interpersonal resources, or communicate and solve problems better that you're facing? We also might work with clients who are experiencing significant conflict in relationships, and that degree of conflict is causing deep emotional pain that's being translated into depressive symptoms. When individuals are experiencing interpersonal disputes, you know, we can kind of normalize it and say, hey, there's been a lot of conflict happening. Of course. You know, it seems like on days when things are calm, your mood is a little better. But when there are these big conflicts, Your mood is really down. You're feeling isolated, hopeless, and you're actually withdrawing from people in your life. How are we going to kind of get our hands and figure out how to handle these disputes? And that might be helping people communicate in different ways. That could be problem solving, right? So we're really goal focused. But I think the first phase of treatment is to really say to the client, to give them something they can understand, to identify maybe not the one causal mechanism that's caused the depression, but to say it does seem like there's been a lot of stuff going on right now that's been adding to your distress. We know in IPT that, you know, depression is multiply determined. You know, we know that there are biological, environmental factors. What we want to kind of focus on is the interpersonal context and how do we move forward in the middle phase of treatment to try to start kind of creating change? How do we help our clients communicate their needs differently? How do we help them solve problems that might be interfering or getting in the way of them feeling connected to others? And then the last focal area is one that is called interpersonal deficits or sensitivities. You know, I think a more contemporary application in IPT is to call them interpersonal sensitivities. And these are really longstanding areas where individuals just struggle, whether it's because of anxiety or lack of skill or lack of opportunity. And these individuals are pretty isolated and lonely. And they really do struggle with finding support, initiating interactions. And so our work with individuals who are depressed or distressed related to interpersonal sensitivities, our work is a lot of kind of thinking about and supporting clients to increase initiation behaviors with other people, right? So how am I going to get out in the world? How am I going to improve my mood by making some changes and trying to develop friendships? And so it's been really interesting, particularly in, you know, in the last 3 years, that in many ways, relationships that isolated people have with friends on the internet, you know, those relationships, you know, maybe 20 years ago were poo-pooed as not real relationships. Now we do know, you know, we would be encouraging people to, you know, explore different modes of connection with other people. In the initial phase, we are really just doing a deep dive, trying to understand the interpersonal context that the distress is kind of manifesting in, and kind of picking a focus area that we'll work on in the middle phase of treatment. The middle phase of treatment really spends a lot of time, we're role-playing, we're talking about skills, we're saying, okay, tell me about the conflict that you had in the last week. Let's see if we can kind of think about approaching it from a different way. Could we use this particular skill? Can we practice it? You know, I as a therapist can model this for you. We can go back and forth. Tell me if this is going to work or not. We call that a communication analysis. You know, if it's a situation where, you know, there's a, I'm struggling adjusting to this new life change, we can kind of figure out together, let's kind of put our heads together and figure out if we can come up with some possible solution to try out. What could we possibly try? We call that a decision analysis. So one, what we're actively doing in the middle phase of treatment is we're not trying to kind of definitively lock down and change every aspect of the focal area that we're working on, but it is really to introduce some proactive skills that involve communicating needs, expressing feelings, and trying different ways of solving interpersonal problems. And then the last phase of IPT, because we said it's a time-limited treatment, is really kind of wrapping up, having a good goodbye with the client, right? Saying, hey, you know, you really worked hard. This was really a pleasure getting to know you. You know, how are you doing right now? Let's look at the progress you've made. Is there stuff that you still want to work on? Maybe we could think about that, extending the treatment or transferring you to a new therapist. Or, you know, possibly augmenting with something else, right? So the idea is we are not going to do IPT until every symptom of depression is necessarily resolved. And if IPT is not a good fit, you know, this is a nice point to say, hey, maybe we can try a different modality of treatment. There are other evidence-based treatments. And as we know, the thing is that, you know, not every evidence-based treatment is going to work as well for every individual. So it's not the idea that, you know, you didn't do well in IPT. It's that IPT wasn't a good fit for you. We made some progress, but now we really want to shift to doing more CBT or DBT, different evidence-based treatments. And I think that, you know, being able to kind of wrap up gives the patient a good degree of agency. Right? That this is not, I'm not permanently sick. I have different treatments. I can make decisions about what sort of treatments I engage in. I can take a break from therapy. I had a good experience. And if I'm depressed again, I might be more willing to seek treatment. So the adult model of IPT, one of the things we know about it, you know, three phases, time limited, focused on interpersonal context. We have an adaptation for adolescents, IPT for depressed adolescents, that was developed by Laura Muffson at Columbia University. And, you know, in many ways, IPT for depressed adolescents retains that three-phase structure in working with adolescents. But there are some key modifications. Parents are involved in up to three parent sessions. We have a series of teen tips for remembering how to communicate differently. And there's more of a developmental focus, right? So there's this idea that adolescents are really going through, all adolescents are going through a transition, a significant life change as they're growing up and becoming more independent. So IPT in some ways is a great fit for adolescents who definitely want to come in, and maybe they're coming in to talk about relationships with peers, with first significant romantic partners, with parents that are changing. So IPT for depressed adolescents is a nice model that has been downwardly extended. And then family-based IPT is the idea that, you know, when we work with younger children's primary interpersonal context is the family. They're not as independent as adolescents. So things that are happening in the family, family grieving the loss of an important individual, that's going to affect children's mood and functioning. Conflict with parents, we certainly hear that a lot, is something that can really affect children's moods. Certainly family transitions, divorce, moving, changing schools. You know, some of these are developmentally normative, you know, moving from a primary school to an upper level school. You know, that could be something that is really distressing. Peer relationships, navigating peer relationships, that's certainly something that comes up as well. So in lots of ways, the IPT model is really being able to kind of look at interpersonal context and how we can help clients and children, youth, improve their relationships in order to support their mood.
Laura, thank you so much. Please take a drink, a sip of water. That was such a great explanation. And I felt like it was so comprehensive and really nicely encapsulating what IPT is about and the four focal areas and what the work is that you'll be doing. And I think if anyone is interested in exploring this, I've really found that it's very effective, especially for Asians, which is why, you know, I'm really interested in developing IPT here, because, you know, Asians are collectivistic, you know, community matters a lot. And so IPT, I think, is underused in the Asian community. So one thing, now moving away, maybe it's a little bit less technical, but something that I've heard before and wanted to get, how would you respond to this, is that the sentiment that I shouldn't be affected by relationships. In fact, I feel that way too. You know, if a friend did something and I'm upset, I get upset, then I'm upset, you know, and then I tell myself, well, you know, why should I be so upset? I shouldn't be upset. I shouldn't let it affect me. And there's this term that we often use called the strawberry generation, and referring to that this, yeah, I know, it's not a nice term. It's a term frequently used to illustrate or it's a metaphor, I guess, to say this generation is bruised easily. You know, they're so sensitive. And I'm wondering whether you think that's true, that this generation is more affected or disproportionately affected by interpersonal events. They have no resiliency, you know, and they're just bruised every time someone on social media says, you know, you're fat, and then they get so hurt. And what's wrong with them? You know, why can't they be more resilient? Back in my day, and thankfully, I didn't grow up with social media, thank God. I mean, I think it's a rough world in social media. You know, so what would you say to that? Is it that people are too sensitive nowadays? Should people not be affected by these interpersonal events as much?
This is so hard. You know, it's so funny. Now that you explain the strawberry generation, I know that we have, you know, in the States, definitely the equivalent of that, whether we call them the snowflake generation or, you know, something like that. You know, I've always kind of struggled with this. I think that one of the things that I've seen in terms of kind of, you know, I teach at the University of Pittsburgh. So you could tell I went into my professor lecture mode when I told you about IPT. But, you know, I've really been able to see and work with millennials, Gen Z, now they have Gen Alpha. I'm also a parent of two teenagers. So I think that in lots of ways, I really try to resist kind of labeling the generation of youth, right? I think that, you know, I started seeing it, you know, everybody's hating on the millennials. And I'm thinking, you know, in some ways, you know, there's something to be said for a generation that is doing things differently. So I think that there is an openness to talking about mental health that has not existed before. And, you know, sometimes when I hear, you know, I don't know what it means. I don't know, you know, with people who say, you know, the strawberry generation, they bruise really easily. Sometimes I think, you know, in terms of intergenerational, wow, what were their lives like? You know, basically, you know, were they the suffer in silence generation? Were they the folks who kind of, right, you know, they were raised with a different set of parents, mm-hmm, and they, you know, don't understand this. I think that I take the stance that it's hard for me to understand the pressures that young people are under. You know, I do think it's very difficult. I, like you, was not raised with social media. So I'm in kind of Generation X. And so, you know, we kind of had a foot in the, you know, the old boomer world and, you know, a foot in the new technology world. But, you know, I think that there are a lot of stressors, and I, you know, certainly see adolescents who are very much struggling with growing up, finding their place in the world. Am I going to be okay? Am I going to get into university? What kind of job am I going to have? Am I going to be good enough? You know, what are the expectations? I think in some ways there are just new challenges to overcome. So I think that there are reasons why this generation is struggling so much. It can't just be that they all bruise easily. You know, I imagine that there are larger factors, and I really feel, you know, I feel for parents as well, right? It's really hard when you don't get it, you know, that your own experience what might be so different than, you know, the next generation, trying to understand what it's like to grow up and come of age. The rules are different now.
it's a time of transition. And that's when I, you know, teenage, pre-adolescent. I mean, pre-adolescents now are so mature. When I think of myself at 8 years old, I think I was kind of dumb. But when I talk to 8-year-olds nowadays, they're very articulate. They're very aware. They've got ideas. You know, I think if we, which is one of the reasons I really love youth, I think if they're empowered, if their ideas were taken seriously, they can really be changing the world for the better. And often this energy is going nowhere. You know, it's kind of sometimes turning inwards in a negative way, turning outwards in a negative way, not productively used, but they have a lot of energy. And I really appreciate what you said, that we actually don't know what's going on with them. You know, we see that they're complaining or they're upset that someone called them fat. But this is, you know, maybe tip of the iceberg. You know, with everything else that's kind of going on, it was like the straw that broke the camel's back. And we just, you know, sort of point at one single factor, because that's what the teen or pre-adolescent could identify, you know, at that point and what made sense in their world. But there could be other things that they didn't even think of that they were affected by. They didn't give themselves credit for actually having to tolerate so much stress already and bear it so much negative emotion.
I completely agree. I think that, you know, the interesting thing is, I think oftentimes, you know how you said, why do people affect me so much? You know, I think that that is a skill that we learn as we get older, right? So we might have skills to say, you know, I had an argument with a coworker, but you know what? Maybe they were just having a bad day. It's not about me. And then maybe we're going to be okay tomorrow. I think with younger children, with pre-adolescence, with adolescents, they don't have that degree of perspective. They can take other people's perspective, but I think the fear is of the fear of being alone, the fear of being excluded. The idea with social media that everybody else has this huge friend group and I am isolated, alone, different, weird, you know, not doing it right, is so painful. And, you know, certainly, you know, I've worked with preteens and adolescents who, you know, have been in situations where they've been told by a friend, no, I'm not going to get together tonight. And then later on, they see that same friend with other friends on Instagram posting pictures, you know, and looking like they had a great time at the movies or at a sleepover. And, you know, it's things like that, that I think for me as a middle-aged woman, I can understand that, but I don't think I can understand it the way that an 11-year-old can, you know, without those layers of protection and wisdom, having gone through things like that. I think that younger people are just more, I think they are more vulnerable because, you know, they're younger. They haven't had the life experience that kind of builds up those layers. And I don't know if that's different than any other generation, except they talk about it more. And I think that, you know, one of the things we do in IPT is to say, yeah, of course that's going to hurt. That, you know, that's kind of how we're wired as human beings, right? That, you know, we might have better skills to cope with. You know, I as a 50-year-old woman might have better skills to cope with seeing that I've been excluded by friends, but ouch, it's still going to sting, you know, and using certain skills like talking about it, getting support, figuring out, do I want to have a conversation with that friend who told me they weren't going out? You know, all of those things, you know, are difficult for children, pre-adolescents and adolescents to do. But we know that these are some of the strategies that help people be able to take a little bit of control of the situation and to help kind of heal that hurt and figure out, you know, I might talk to that friend who says to me, oh my gosh, Laura, I'm so sorry. You know, I wasn't planning on going out. And then, you know, a good friend of mine reached out and said, please, 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 would I come to this party with them? I'm so sorry. I know. Of course you were hurt. My intention was not to ditch you for the evening. And I wish I would have communicated better with you about that. You know, we would be able to salvage that relationship. I think it's hard for young people to develop those skills. Mm-hmm. And I also think that for older people, I do think I on the one hand, empathize with, oh, are you kidding me? This is why you're upstairs crying. I can empathize with that. But then I can also say, wow, I mean, I could not even imagine being a young person in the age of social media these days.
I mean, I have to confess, when you said, of course it'll sting, and I was like, yeah, I also have those experiences where we said, hey guys, are you guys going out? And like, no, everyone's going home, and then they go out without me, and you're like, oh my god, was that deliberate? And you're so spot on with saying that it takes time to develop a way to cope with this with that hurt, right? And you get to decide whether these are friendships that are worth keeping, right? And that what you need to do is also then have to remember that this is not the only event in your friendship. You know, what is this person, has this person shown trustworthy behavior before? Is this that one-time transgression? You know, is this person safe enough or worthwhile enough for you to invest in talking about having that difficult conversation? And then sometimes I think what I do is I just go to best friends, you know, friends that I'm close with, and get that comfort, you know, and says, yeah, it really sucks, and get soothed and think, who wants to go out with them anyway?
That's right. And doesn't that feel so much better? That makes you feel so much better.
It's, you know, just feed back that self-esteem and remember that there are plenty of other people who loves you and care for you.
I think that's really one of the things that I think is the benefit to sometimes shore up those family relationships, right? So I think that, you know, we do an exercise called the closeness circle with adolescents and with pre-adolescents. It looks kind of like a bullseye, you know, with concentric circles, and we put the adolescent or the youth in the middle, and then we kind of map out, you know, who are your super close? Who are the people that you're super close with? And then the people that you're, you know, less close with, but, you know, they're still friends. And then the folks that maybe might be acquaintances. So to realize that there can be different degrees of intimacy within relationships. And, you know, who are the people that you go to when you're saying, ouch, that really stings? You know, who are the people? And oftentimes what we're seeing is that, you know, if adolescents or pre-adolescents, if they have some family members, a parent, an older sister, an older brother, an aunt, an uncle, a grandparent, somebody in their family that is their go-to person who's going to say, you know what? Oh, I'm so sorry that happened to you. Oh, that stinks. Who wants to spend time with them anyway? Yeah.
Right? You're still some ice cream and forget those jerks.
Absolutely. You know, I think that, you know, one of the things that's when I work with the preteens, with the pre-adolescents, you know, one of the ways that I try to loop the parents in is to say, they need you. They need you. They're moving into their teen years. You know, you need to be that anchor. How can you help them when they've had a hard day, or that they're being faced with decisions? Their peer group is wanting to do X, Y, and Z, and they're not feeling comfortable with that. You know, how can you help anchor them? How are you two going to talk about these hard things? How are you going to have better communication? Because oftentimes what we see is, you know, in some families, when there's conflict between children and parents, there's often a standoff, right? There's distance. So to kind of talk about, hey, we need to kind of figure out how we can minimize this conflict, because we need you two to be able to communicate, because, you know, adolescence is coming, and the situations, you know, your child is going to need to be able to feel like they can come and talk to you. And I think this is one of the things that really kind of can motivate parents to think about things differently. So not that they give up having limits and rules. They're still parents. They're not acting like they're children's best friends. But the idea is, how are we going to make sure that we can have conversations? So maybe I'm adjusting my parenting stance a little bit, in terms of moving from more of an authoritarian, like, these are my rules, this is what we do, to kind of saying, okay, your curfew's at this time. Tell me what's going on. Why were you late? What's going on here? How are we going to kind of make sure that you're safe? So being able to kind of be able to have a conversation in a way that doesn't undermine the parent's authority, but the parent can also kind of communicate in a way that doesn't isolate their children.
Fascinating conversation. I wish I had more time, because there's so many questions about, like, what about social media and what about AI? I'm really interested in, like,
oh my goodness, AI. Right?
I know.
And but what are we gonna say?
I know. Oh, Laura, but it's okay. We'll have you back again. To wrap up, this is like end state, just like IPT. And then one of the things that struck me as you were talking is how useful IPT can be for learning how to build healthy relationships. I like the approach of prevention, but I don't like that that's when we start thinking about doing something healthy, only when we're trying to prevent an illness. So, you know, what you were saying of just how to listen, how to be an anchor, this doesn't need to be about thinking, oh, I need to do this to prevent my child from being depressed. It's also about, how do I get close to my child, and how do I build a good relationship with my child? How do I communicate with my child and help my child to grow up, you know, able to manage the pressures of life and to find their own way to be in this world? So, you know, do you have any, I know it's going to be maybe cliche, or it's going to be difficult, advice. What is your top advice for parents, caregivers, on how they can best support young children? Do we just allow the bad mood to go and say, well, those are just teens, you know, teens are always in a bad mood? Do we need to seek treatment early? Is it pathologizing everything?
You know, at a certain point, yes. I mean, a lot of times people will say, this is normal pre-adolescence. This is normal, you know, adolescence, the stress and storm of adolescence. For parents, it's very helpful to have someone to talk to. And I would say that, you know, it's easy for me to say, but I think that if parents are concerned about their children, that it does make sense to partner with a support person, a mental health professional, to kind of talk about, you know, I'm not sure what to do here. I think a lot of parents, you know, before they seek treatment, you know, often put off seeking treatment for their children, but they've been concerned for a while. I think it's always hard to know when is the right time, especially if you have a child that's not very open to this. I would say, you know, parents can start modeling, you know, talking to their children by just saying, you know, it seems like you've been really sad, shut down, isolated. You know, all right, what's going on? How are you feeling? Would you be willing to talk to somebody? Can we talk to somebody in our community, in our church, in our, you know, your doctor? What do you think about that? You know, and just kind of reaching out to youth, you know, checking in with them. I do think that, you know, in terms of how do we best support our youth, you know, I think that it is important for parents to partner with child development specialists, therapists, psychiatrists, pediatricians, to have these conversations. How do I support my child? What's the right thing to do right now? You know, I do think that reaching out for help is terrifying, but oftentimes it's, you know, those decisions that once people make them, they say, wow, I should have done this 6 months ago. It is difficult because of the stigma. I definitely agree. But I do think that for parents, you know, if you're at a point where you're not sure what to do, your child is engaging in any kind of self-injurious behaviors, they're talking about suicide, I would definitely say that absolutely, that is when you want to be talking to a mental health professional. But, you know, I like to really I like to really work with parent strengths. You know your child. You know, what have you been observing? Well, they're not spending time with people. They're in their room all the time. What is their mood like? They're crying. They're angry. You know, they're not doing as well in school. They don't want to go to school. They don't want to do the, you know, these might be some situations that would be great to discuss with a mental health professional.
It's almost like just start by reaching out, you know, and I think that's, there's never a bad time to start that, you know, start reaching out. And as even as your child grows up and they're going through some changes and they tend to detach from parents, but you can continue that reaching out, even if it's one way, because it's, you know, what you said, like just modeling that and persisting in that. Even though you don't get an answer immediately. And I find with teens is that you have to prove that you are ready to listen. You know, you have to prove That's to right. your teen that yes, I am genuinely interested. It's not a once-off thing. And when you gain their trust, they would really share. And it may not be you that they share with. I think what's important is that they do find someone. And I really appreciate your message there, just encouraging parents to seek help for themselves. You know, support is not just for your child, it's also for you.
And I think that adolescents still need their parents. Mm-hmm. And so whether the parents are involved in therapy peripherally or more integrated into the work, you know, I do think that feeling like regardless of what happens in the world, I see you, I love you, I support you, I have your best interest at heart, I have your back. What emerging adult does not thrive with that information?
Yeah. I mean, I still want it, but
absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I mean, mommy, I still want my mommy. So thanks, Laura, for joining us on Being Human.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really a pleasure.
And thank you for tuning into this episode of Being Human. We'll be hosting guests on a regular basis, so be sure to tune in for some more insights on how we can understand ourselves better and learn to live a life on our own terms and one that's meaningful to us. My name is Dr. Chua Suk Ning, and I look forward to sharing some more valuable insights from the world of mental health with you very soon.
Thank you for listening to the Being Human podcast. To find out more about Relate Malaysia's online therapy services, visit us at www.relate.com.my or email us at inquires@relate.com.my. You can also find us on Facebook and Instagram. Until next time, remember, we are all more human than we are otherwise. Be kind to yourself and take care.